Okay, well, it sounds like we're good to go for today's HSTLD conference call. And what I'll do as normal is go ahead and start with the roll call. The folks that have indicated they're on the line, is it DeCicco?
DeCicco.
DeCicco, okay. I'm sure I'll get that one after a couple of calls. We have Pam DeCicco, who's participating from VeriSign, who is stepping in now that Pat Kane has got his hands more full with some other new duties. So welcome, Pam, to the group.
Thank you.
We've got Lynn Goodendorf. We've got Paul Smosher. We've got Eric Brunner-Williams. We have Michael Pelage. And we have Steve Crocker. Is there anyone that I've missed?
And I've just gotten an IM from Dave Piscatello, who said that something has come up quite urgently, and he's got to take care of it as a personal thing. He apologizes.
Okay.
Hey, this is John McElwain. I'm on the line.
Hey, John.
Jonathan Frakes here, too.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, everyone. Mike. Happy holidays.
Yeah.
Mikey's on.
Hi, Mikey. Welcome back from the Ecuadorian rainforest, Mikey.
It's quite a transition. It was 90 yesterday, and it's 20 here in Minnesota, and there's 25 inches of snow on the ground. It's really...
Well, why don't we go ahead and get started with today's call. I'm going to turn the conversation over to Michael Pelage, who is the chair of the call.
Thanks, Craig. So, again, I recognize that we're in the height of the holiday season here, so I'd like to try to keep this call short and sweet, but did want to have it because I think there was some important benchmarks that we wanted to set to meet our original time frames. And, again, just to remind everybody what our objectives are here, we would ideally like to have a draft of our final report out by the beginning of February, which would allow then for 1 to 2 weeks of, shall we say, revision and tweaking that would allow it to then get out for publication, for public comment, I believe. Craig, I think we were talking by the week of the 21st, which would give us the 21 days required notice in advance of the San Francisco meeting. So
yeah,
those
right.
are the big timelines that we're looking at, and as far as trying to move forward with deliverables. Now, with regard to that, one of the first things we're going to have to do in formulating our final report is to begin to review and synthesize the various RFIs that have been returned. So at this point, Craig, could you perhaps give us an idea of which ones have been received, whether we should be expecting any more, or where we're exactly at on that particular fact-based gathering exercise in this initiative?
Sure, Michael, happy to do that. So today we've received two responses to the RFI, one from KPMG, and the second from Deloitte and Touche. Both of them, no surprise, were in addition to providing answers to questions, pitches for some new business for themselves to help us actually build the program that we would then RFP out for someone to administer. The KPMG response was fairly concise. I think it was about 14 pages. And the Deloitte and Touche response was pretty exhaustive. It was almost 40 pages. I think the Deloitte and Touche response went into a lot more detail about the various types of, or I should say levels of, either auditing or assurance type programs that we might consider, and the positives and negatives associated with those varying levels. I'm happy to share those responses with the group. And we'll do so after today's call. I did have a call yesterday with PwC based on a communication I'd received from them that they were not going to respond. Ken Michaels, who is a gentleman who had participated in the call we had with potential respondents a few weeks ago, and I chatted for a while yesterday, and he was getting, I guess, a fair amount of pressure from his senior-level partners about how much time and resources PwC put into responding to the RFI. It still, on a lot of levels in their eyes, was not clear enough. That is, you know, what's the problem that's trying to be solved, and what are the potential benefits? What is the demand? I mean, and a number of questions that this group has internally discussed among itself. So PwC will not be responding. I'm happy to share also some notes that I took from that call, and I'll circulate those to the group. I did reach out this morning to Grant Thornton and Ernst & Young, who both had previously expressed some interest, and we haven't received anything from them, and my outreach was to see whether we could anticipate something, and if not, perhaps set up some time to discuss why that might be or the reasons behind that. I think it's safe to say that from that kind of bidders call that we had several weeks ago now, that the groups that we were talking to, the KPMGs and the PwCs, are all bound by certain principles administered by AICPA, and which really kind of ties their hands around the kind of work that they can do for organizations like ICANN and other groups that are looking for to develop attestation type auditing programs. So it's not a complete surprise that Grant Thornton and Ernst & Young didn't respond. That's kind of where we are with the two responses, or with the responses or the non-responses.
Sorry, Craig. I thought you were done. I'll let you finish, and then follow.
No, I'm done. My last point was that I'll circulate those responses to the group and ask that they be kept just among the group. Deloitte and Touche's is marked confidential, so please do not distribute these materials beyond this working group.
So with that in context, you'll probably have to then, since our mailing list is publicly archived, you'll probably have to then send it to the members individually, correct? Is that what you will do to...
That makes sense.
I'm just trying to raise that as a point. Seeing how I am a zealot for open and transparency, and our mailing list has been publicly archived, if someone has given us something in confidence, I want to respect that. And then perhaps what we could do as in preparing our report, perhaps what we could do is those elements where we may want to reference sort of a summary of the responses, perhaps we could share that with the respondents to see if they would have no objections to that element or that summary being shared publicly as part of our final report. So
okay.
I'll leave that. And then I get just a sort of another follow-up here, Craig. I know we've had some recording problems. I know recently with the switchover to Adigo, the call that we had with the RFI respondents, we had no problem with that recording, correct? That was all?
Correct, and that was posted, I think,
I know it was immediately. Okay, I know you're generally pretty timely with that. So as I said, what happens is, in response, as part of going through this from, if you will, a fact-based determination of what we, the group, did, since we originally, I guess what, we had like five or six potential auditing firms that participated in that call, the fact that we only have two respondents, I think we may want to go back and in our report more accurately summarize, because we really did have a good dialogue regarding, I think, the attestation requirements, limitations, and make sure that is included. So as I said, I appreciate that update. Just to sit there and before we move on to the second item on the call, which is question 35 in the applicant guidebook, is there anyone, as usual, I'll just go through the list real quickly. Is there anyone that has a problem, concern, any issues with where we're at as far as response from the RFIs and how we will potentially go about incorporating that into our final report. So, Lynn, I usually go sequentially, but since you're the rookie on the call, I'm going to move you to the end, and I'll sort of start with Lynn. So, Lynn, do you want to go first? Any comments, concerns on the RFIs and how we might be incorporating their work?
No, I'm comfortable with what's been outlined.
Okay, Paul.
Yeah, I was kind of intrigued by Craig's comment that the two that we've got in have suggested they could certainly help us with defining the management of the program. Intrigued for two reasons. Number one, I thought it was pretty clear when we had the conversation with them a couple of weeks ago that I certainly walked away with the impression they could not manage the program. So having not had a chance to look at the RFIs yet, I'm assuming that's really around, we'll help you set it up, but we can't do it ourselves.
That's right, Paul.
Okay. And secondly, I guess, and maybe this isn't the time or the place, but it really does get to a pretty fundamental concern that I've been mulling around, which is absent the kind of at least tacit support we seem to be getting from ICANN, I have a much larger question around who is going to manage the program and how the funding is going to come for managing the program. And there's a part of me that thinks I'm not sure how, I guess they're independent in the sense that somebody could certify against our current standards, but there's a part of me that wonders how stale those standards are going to get if there's no one really managing them, and how are we going to set up the management of the certification process itself, and blah, blah, blah. So I think it's great we got RFIs from a couple well-respected firms, but and I have no problem, like, getting to your specific question of the sharing and the summarizing and putting that in the final response, but there is this lingering bigger question in my mind.
No, I think those are all fair and valid points, Paul. To address the issue of potentially cost aspects, Craig, perhaps you could work with I think Juan, the new controller, perhaps you can get us some metrics on the cost that ICANN invested with regard to Andy's work when he was with KPMG in helping with some of the drafting of the control elements, because I think that would provide at least some reference to the level of support that allowed us to get to this point in time in our work. I don't want to ask for a breakdown of your salary, but we at least get some idea of what has been expected of, I think, both you and Dave over the last year. But the outside component of cost associated with Andy's contribution, we're just looking ballpark here, I think.
I'm not sure I understand the value of that information.
Well, I guess, again, this is just a question that I was trying to sit there. And what I heard from Paul is, and correct me if if I've heard this improperly, Paul, you're asking for sort of some idea of what it will cost, right? Because some of these people, the KPMGs that have initially responded, have said, we could help set up the program, right? That's what they're talking about. Set it up, not necessarily run it. So since we're trying to do fact-based determinations and part of the viability and implementation of this program is going to be based on cost, we need to look at dollars and cents, okay? And when I look at the work that we have done as a group over the last year, I think we would have been hard-pressed to get where we're at today without a lot of the heavy lifting that Andy did during the spring and summer earlier this year in getting us to that point. Unlike the other people on this call that are volunteers, he was paid by ICANN as a consultant to help this group do its work. So I think knowing what ICANN's contributions or, you know, what at least some metrics of the investment in his time and effort is a reasonable data point that we should acknowledge in our final report. That's my, I don't want to say it's an opinion, it's just sort of something that I want to put out there for consideration. Paul, I mean, is this, would you agree or disagree? Again, I'm just trying to address what I thought I heard was concerns that you had raised.
Well, I think at some point it's going to be important for us to understand what the costs of managing the program would be. I think there's maybe kind of a predecessor task that we need to define what all we're considering under the term managing the program, and then probably do some data searching to figure out what that's all going to cost. You know, I would certainly suggest that, you know, a part of our final report needs to address the fact that this program needs to be managed, and you know, and I doubt if in 3 weeks or so we're going to have a solution to how it's going to be managed. But I think we need to spend some time in the report talking about the management and talking about the costs and, you know, maybe making suggestions with regard to who could manage it. So at some point, yes, you know, we probably need, as a proxy, some idea of the cost that ICANN previously spent to hire a consultant to help get the program off the ground. That would serve as a pretty good proxy for some of the costs associated with managing the program. But I don't know if we need to have that sooner rather than later. I think maybe the first step is figuring out what defines managing the program to us.
All right. So thanks, Paul. I'm going to move down the list. Eric, you were next in the roll call. Any comments, contributions?
Thank you, Michael. Can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Good. My first observation is that we've not done the SOI-DOI declaration. And since the last fall, I have some change in that I'm now a regional officer of ALAC.
All right.
I suggest that Craig sends a notice of the confidentiality material being sent to the working group members on the mailing list so that there is a public record of the distribution of confidential material, which is off the record. I know we're talking about it on this call, which is archived, but mailing lists are really the vehicle of record. And on the actual RFIs, I really don't have a response until I actually read the two of them. I want to point out, relative to the conversation we've just had about expense, that we do have a sketch of, an incomplete sketch of nominal estimated cost to implement the controls that we have. I don't claim that gives us great insight on what the administrative cost is going to be, but it is some information that we do have. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, and very good process points regarding the expression of interest. So I will try to move that to the front of every call. Very valid point, and also agree with Craig sending out just notice to the email list about the off-list distribution. So two very good points. Thank you. Moving down the list, John McElwain, you're next.
You know, I really don't have anything to add. I'd like to review the responses, but fine with the process so far.
Excellent. Mikey?
It's Mikey. Can you hear me okay?
Hear you fine.
Same thing. I'd like to read the responses. I think that one of the things that I would just point out is that sometimes thin responses to RFPs and RFIs are an indication that maybe it's time to step back and rethink the underpinnings of that thing. And I think this is the message that I'd like to highlight, at least prior to reading the responses. I don't think that we've got a good sense of how to make a TLD secure yet. And until we can say that in a clearer way, I think that part of the reason we're not getting a whole lot of response is because we're confusing people. So I think the meta message in the thin response, for me at least, is something along those lines.
All right. And as I put it this way, Mikey, as far as stepping back and looking at the big picture, that's kind of what the final report is sort of meant to convey. So I think that's what the final report is designed to do, is give the big picture. Because I think as we've gone through here, unfortunately you missed last week's call with eTrust, which I think added some contextual elements that have been along the lines that you have expressed. So that is why the final report will include all metrics, and again is designed with the affirmation of commitments to be fact-based. We are going to identify all the blocks that we, the group, have considered over the last 12 months of our work. So I would agree with that, and hopefully that would have addressed your concerns. Pam, I am now going to come back to you as the rookie on the call. Do you have any contributions?
No, given that I am a rookie, I'm just going to listen for a while.
All right. And Steve and Craig, as usual, yes, Jonathan Frakes. Jonathan, I apologize there. Any interventions or contributions from yourself?
No, not really. I was going to razz you about how to label things so that they stay on the list or don't go on the list. But the labeling, I think, is one thing that we really want to have as a consideration of this. I'm grateful that we've gotten where there might be an elective value point inside of the question 35 and how that will help an applicant, you know, as some sort of a value to going through this elective voluntary program. But I still stand strong to the belief that labeling or having some sort of a label on a TLD that elevates the presence of that TLD being a more trusted, more secure platform is still going to be something strong. And I think it ties into who and how that program is centrally managed. I still stand to the belief that if that is ICANN, that having ICANN's label on a high security TLD is going to be of great value. And it's going to be really important that we have some sort of a visibility for the general applicant and the general internet user to be able to see that a TLD is in fact of a higher standard for security, especially in the case of financial transactions or other things that are listed in question 35. And that's all.
Excellent. Thank you. And now to circle back, as usual, to give ICANN staff, and in this case ICANN board, any sort of last final words. So Craig or Steve?
Craig, do you want to go first?
No, I'm going to let you have it, Steve.
Okay. So thank you very much, Michael. So let me say two or three things, and I'll try to be quite short about this. I guess I am participating in two capacities here, both as an ICANN board member and as chair of the Security and Stability Advisory Committee. With respect to SSAC, I have to offer a bit of an apology. I believe that when this group was first set up, there was a co-chair supplied from SSAC, Christoph Rivard. And I didn't follow the action as closely as perhaps we should have. And in any case, Christoph has now resigned from SSAC, and I suspect that the total contribution that we've made may have been a little less than perhaps we should have. So one of my reasons for stepping into this is a sense of the concern that we had not contributed as much as we should have, and I'm trying to sort of catch up and be helpful in that process. So I am perhaps, I don't know if it's appropriate, but to the extent that there's been missing SSAC participation in the past, I'm trying to supply that on the fly here as rapidly as possible. From my board perspective, my attention was strongly moved to this topic when the board met in Trondheim, Norway, and went through quite a few things related to the GTLD program. And the HSTLD program was presented to the board, and the interactions played out a bit awkwardly, at least from my perspective, in that we asked a couple of questions about the program. The responses that we heard were not immediately compelling, and didn't lay to rest the questions that we were asking. And then what ensued from there seemed to be sort of even less helpful, in that we heard management say, well, then maybe we'll back away from this or something. And then next thing I know, there was a resolution. And I don't think, just speaking for myself and perhaps more candidly than some of my colleagues might like, I didn't think that whole sequence came out as constructively as it could have. And I don't want to cast blame in any particular place, because there may be multiple places for it. But it did cause me to raise my attention level and say, maybe it's time to look closely at what's going on here. I have spent a little bit of time since then and had a couple of conversations, and I can see that there's been quite a lot of work in implementation issues, and it looks like it's all been well-intentioned and well done. What's uppermost in my mind is exactly what the objective is, and what is meant by the term high security TLD, and what are people supposed to understand from that. I don't want to, I suspect this isn't the right time or place, but I wanted to plant a flag there, or a bookmark, I suppose, and indicate that that's where my attention is, and where I think there may be some room to be helpful. I think Mikey's comment about the implicit messages coming back from the RFI resonate very much with me, and as I say, I suspect that there's room here to untangle a little bit what it is the program's trying to accomplish compared to how it's going about it. I also agree that labels are very important and that they should convey specific meanings. I am more neutral. I don't have any preconception one way or the other about who administers it or where the imprimatur comes from, but I do agree that the message ought to be very clear, and from that we can then work out the details of how to implement it and how to administer it and what the costs are and so forth.
Well, to put it this way, thank you, Steve. Thanks for the insight. It is always helpful, whether you're wearing your ESSAC or your board chair hat, to have that that insight. It really helps us in sort of knowing where, you know, we need to go. And in our efforts. And just a couple of points there. The work of the ESSAC has been important. In fact, one of the things Dave Piscatello did very early on is actually give a briefing on all of the ESSAC reports dealing with some of the security issues, particularly on the registrar side, some of the work that ESSAC has done there. So that actually created some of the initial foundation work that we as a group did. Just one other point is, you know, membership is never closed. It's always been an open door. Anybody could come in at any time, as evidenced by Pam, who is sort of taking on a new role now that Pat has moved on at VeriSign. So if you believe there's someone from ESSAC that could perhaps contribute, the fact that, and I say this a little self-servingly, because we have a lot of work as a group to get done over the next 4 to 6 weeks. So if someone is from ESSAC is willing to contribute, roll up their sleeves, and help us put out a representative document of the work of the group over the last years, it's always an open door.
Good. Well, I appreciate that. You take my participation here as a positive response, in the sense that, to first order, I've already rolled up my sleeves. I have a few thoughts related to clarification of the message and what the objectives are. As I say this, I won't attempt to start that conversation here, but I'm sort of ready to engage. And then separately, I have put onto our administrative process in within FSAC exactly the question of how to get more attention and more help for this. And I will be carrying that back to the subsequent conversations that we'll have within FSAC.
Much appreciated. So moving on to, I guess, the second issue, which I just wanted to bring to everyone's attention is the most recent applicant guidebook, question 35, has made at least some reference to the potential work as part of the evaluation criteria. And this is part of, if you will, a subset of the security policy questions that now appear, as I said, as question 35. And I was wondering perhaps if I could sort of just go through the group and get their perspective on how we might go about in our final report addressing this. And the reason I think I want to try to raise this question is since we have had no sort of preconceived conceptions on where this final report will end up. One potential resolution is there is no consensus. We can't decide on anything, so you know there is no outcome. That is one path that has been articulated by some participants. I know other participants have a much clearer, shall we say, outcome of where they would like to see this group go. But since we have, shall we say, not precluded any particular outcome, I think we just want to have this discussion as to question 35 and how that may impact our final report. Has everybody read the text that I sent from question 35 to the list earlier, about an hour or two ago?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I'll take silence as acceptance. So, with that point there, I'm just going to again go through the list to see if we could sort of have any insights or contributions. So, again, I'm going to start off with Lynn. Lynn, do you have any contributions or insights on question 35 and our work that we're doing?
I had just had the expectation that our final report and recommendations as an advisory group would go to the ICANN board. If that's not who we direct it to, then I'm open to whether or not some other, committee or group within ICANN would be appropriate. But that was my expectation.
No, and as I said, as I tried to articulate, I know there are some members that have some expectations, but as chair, I'm trying to keep all options on the table until we produce our final report that's
sure.
going to be based upon the facts. So, again, I have to be a little more open to considering all possible outcomes to be fair to all members. And I think one of the reasons that I was just trying to focus on this is when we heard eTrust, who you had participated last
week. Or trustee.
Trustee, uh-huh. When they had participated, they were talking about a much more end-user type of system as opposed to, I think, some of the control elements that we were focusing on that appear to be more applicant guidebook related. So, again, I just wanted to consider that in that. And Lynn, with your security background, the applicant guidebook talks about, if we can't do it, are there other control elements that ICANN may be able to reference? So I guess I'll tee this up for both you and Paul, who's in the queue. If we are unable to come up with a final set of control elements, might you be able to come up with other data points that ICANN may be able to incorporate into the applicant guidebook? I think that needs to be a safety net that we consider, since ICANN has specifically said HSTLD or other applicable standards or control elements. So,
I think, the an alternative approach that ICANN has, not only for new GTLTs, but for TLDs in general, is that you know, the strongest control they have is actually their contracts and contractual compliance. And, you know, we've seen this past year that ICANN has stepped up their efforts to terminate different players who, you know, really fell down on their contractual compliance. And that's a really effective way of making sure, you know, that certain standards are met. I think the difficulty there is that we were interested in what we called higher level of security, and typically for contracts you would set some type of minimum requirements so that everyone would have to meet some kind of minimum baseline. But that could certainly be developed to say we want to bring everybody up in the registration food chain to a certain minimum level of security. And maybe in some ways, I mean, it could be argued that that might ultimately have more impact to bring everybody up to some kind of baseline level.
All right. Thanks. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, again, same question here. If you have any contributions on this?
Yeah, we are certainly looking at the question of alternatives in two senses. Number one, you know, if the HSTLD program you know, does not result in a set of standards that become certifiable, number one, and number two, we're looking at it in the sense of, for our particular industry, are there things beyond the HSTLD standards that we would like to see incorporated as well? For example, some things in the registrar-registrant space that maybe aren't emphasized quite as much in the current standards. And, you know, we're recognizing that HSTLD to this point is good and strong, but it's also come through a series of compromises and concerns, so it may not quite cover everything we want to do. But, yeah, the short answer, I guess, is yes, we are looking at supplements to HSTLD related to our industry. So we are doing some work in that space.
Excellent. Thanks. And Paul, as I said, I think you focused, again, primarily on the financial security sector. But if with some of your colleagues in other sectors, I think we've talked about this before, either in the health or other sectors that may have different standards, you know, perhaps if they could offer some data points that ICANN may consider, that would really be helpful as well. Eric Bruner-Williams, you are up, my friend.
Thank you, Michael. This is Eric Bruner-Williams. I want to first mention that the reference to the HSTLD and the DAG is something that we have previously reached consensus would not be the case. So how the language which we currently have in the DAG in question 35 contains a reference to HSTLD is something which has occurred outside of working group process or advisory group process. It certainly, to the best of my recollection, it is not what we consent to. Leaving that minor point aside, next I'd like to say that to Steve that as the group has had a very limited agenda, I look forward to your initial position by email. And now finally to the to question 35 itself, Michael, I've written almost a page of comments on this, and I'm sure not everyone wants to hear me read it. Mostly I've been addressing the statement requirement to get a score of 2 in this triple valued metric, and I find that the values associated with a score of 2 are actually fairly indefensible. And while this, you know, question 35 is actually part of the DAG, and so the proper venue is to make a comment in the now explicit comment period through the 15th of January. What we do have as a group is we sort of have a return to our original condition
which is where we have to train our original control author, Andy Welsh, about the non-necessity of recapitulating the content that is in the DAG. So, I'm happy to stop there.
Well, as I said, I guess there's two data points there, and Steve, you know, I know one of the commitments that I heard from the board was to explain some of its decision-making process in connection with the applicant guidebook. So I think this goes to your point, Eric. You know, how did that specific reference to the HSTLD work its way in? Maybe some explanation, because, again, there was no formal position by this group itself to incorporate it. Eric, if you want, as far as Andy is in the process of leaving KPMG and going to, I think, Goldman Sachs. So I think as far as the final handling of the control elements, that is primarily going to fall to this group here over the next 5 to 6 weeks as we finalize our final work product there. Okay?
Thank you, Michael. Actually, I wasn't so much interested in how the in Steve's comments on how the language came back into the DAG as I was on his suggestion that his initial position is not completely contained by the existing control-oriented draft that the working group has produced thus far.
Okay. Thank you for that important call. That's important. Thank you. Moving to John McElwain. John, any comments, contributions on this question 35 issue?
I like question 35 the way it's drafted. I mean, I'm a big proponent that there should be some reference of HSTLD when evaluating applicants. I would, we've talked in the past about giving applicants a point or more if they agree to reach an HSTLD certification as a way to provide a benefit for applicants to have a more safe and secure zone. So I personally like the way it is written into the applicant guidebook right now.
All right, excellent. And that's why we have a whole bunch of different participant members on this group. We have a wide range of views, which is important towards our final output. Jonathan Frakes, you're up.
Thank you. So I really like that we have question 35 worded as it is. I still am concerned that as it's worded for a score of 2 as opposed to a score of 1, there's the point that's clarified, the item 5 under one point score would be, proposed security measures are commensurate with the nature of the applied for GTLD string. And I really think that also belongs underneath the score of 2, such that, it could be clarified. Because, the set of control standards are very good, but there's a concern that I have that these standards might be overburdensome for somebody who might have something similar they're proposing in a community where, they're not going to need the shored up confidence that a financial or healthcare type of TLD would need, but they may have higher security standards than, other applicants. So, if we went back and applied the standard, does .museum need to be risen to an HSTLD standard? Probably not. And I think given the variety of profiles that I've seen in the applicant pool, there's people who do definitely have these stronger technical capabilities that aren't necessarily going to have them to the degree the HSTLD program might outline for financial or healthcare type records. And the concern that I have is that an overburdensome set of standards for a score of 2 might unfairly advantage certain service providers or certain applicants
and disadvantage, you know, folks in the community who may not have the same, you know, technical or financial wherewithal to qualify for a two-point score here, the way it's worded currently.
Okay, and I think that I think they are valid points, and again, definitely need to be considered and incorporated in our final fact-based gathering. So I think that that would be important. Mikey, you are next in the queue.
Thanks, Mike. This is Mikey. This is going to be sort of off the cuff because I really have just seen this about an hour ago when you sent it, but a lot of my questions just sort of get reamplified here. One question is, what's the scope of this thing? If the scope of the HSTLD is only aimed at the registry, then these words and phrases kind of work. But if the scope that we've been at least talking about, although I don't think we've agreed to, of going all the way out to registrar and even registrant in order to qualify for an HSTLD is really where we're headed, then I don't think these words work right because they don't acknowledge that broader scope of control. I love Steve's question about the objective. That's really mine, too. When I read these, this is a kind of a nice list if you were trying to secure a data center. But that's kind of like the wrong thing to secure. I mean, what we're trying to secure is a TLD. And so my reaction to this is sort of the same as it is to everything else that we've got. It's sort of like we're doing the thing we know how to do, but we're not really achieving the real goal. I am surprised to see HSTLD kinds of things in the applicant guidebook because we had a pretty heavy-duty discussion for the first few months of this working group where we finally hammered out this agreement that this was going to be voluntary, and it seems like this runs counter to that. So it's surprising and kind of a swing and a miss in my view. Thanks.
All right. Last in the participants call, we have Pam. Any contributions?
Oh, just a couple of agreements. I think Jonathan has excellent points. And also I'd agree with Mikey in that, you know, our understanding it would be a voluntary program.
All right.
And that's
excellent. Excellent. And we have about 5 minutes left here. And so what I will do here is I will, again, just to keep us on time here, we have 6 minutes left. So Steve or Craig, I will give you the last final words on this before wrapping up the call.
No, I think I've said what I wanted to say, and I'll look forward to having some subsequent follow-up discussions.
And well, actually, I think I speak for the group. We welcome that that input. As I said, both from yourself wearing ESAC or board hat, your contributions will definitely be welcome. So what I'd like to do here is I'm going to bring the call to a close. The only thing I want to do, just real quick, from an administrative standpoint, is did I miss somebody?
Yes, actually, I wanted to make sure I had Steve Crocker's email address, as I don't know if he's on the mailing list yet.
I am just now on the mailing list, I believe. I got a welcome message. Craig Schwartz asked me if I wanted to join. I said yes, and it happened quickly. But for any who care, I can be reached directly, Steve, S-T-E-V-E, at shinkuro.com. Shinkuro is S-H-I-N-K-U-R-O, shinkuro.com.
Okay. So again, this is the last administrative point. Our next call is going to be January 5th.
So I would encourage everyone, after Craig sends us privately the RFIs individually, if we could if we can read them. And again, because there are elements to that which are confidential, please avoid discussing specific components on the public mailing list. Again, I just think that that's important to preserve the confidences that some of the respondents have requested. And I think on that January 5th call, right now let's leave it for 1 hour, but perhaps after I also roll up my sleeves and read through the RFIs, we may want to consider during the month of January possibly exploring the two-hour format. We had to do that back in the spring when we were producing the control elements, but right now I'm going to propose leaving January 5th as a one-hour call, but for everyone, we may want to consider going back to a two-hour while we try to crank out this report in the rather short time frame. So thank you, everyone. Have a good holiday season and a good new year. Thanks again.
Thank you. And with respect to that, the 1 hour at the same time at 12:30 Eastern time?
That has seemed to have worked. We tried rotating originally to get some East and European participation.
I'm not trying to apply any pressure. Just want to make sure I understand.
Yeah, that's. We're probably going to be staying at the 12:30 slot. I think right now, unless there's any objection.
Within.
Excellent. Thanks again, everyone. And
thanks, Michael.
Alrighty, bye.
Good, Michael.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Mike.
Craig?
Left.